Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc. All rights reserved.
When you're down and troubled and you need a helping hand.
We're back. It's 12 after. 800-531-3815, toll-free coast-to-coast. We have a couple of good friends with us this morning, Eleanor Solomon and Richard DeKaiser, two of our good friends and longtime members of our Brain Trust. Couldn't do without them. Eleanor is just an outstanding resource for us and still so steadfast as the other absolute perennial member of the FedWatch show every time. She's the author of Virtual Money, How Understanding the Risks, the Power and Risks of Money's High-Speed Journey into Electronic Space. She's a professor of economics at George Washington University and a former economist with the Fed. She's our good friend. Eleanor, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure.
It's always a pleasure to have you back. And also Richard DeKaiser, who's chief economist with the National City Bank. I'll get it out in a minute. National City Bank and up in the Midwest. He's our good friend. Richard, welcome back.
Good to be here, Jim.
It's good to have you back, Richard. And as we typically do, let's just do a little run-through of the economy. And Richard, as you know, we always have ladies first around here. So, Eleanor, why don't you give us a little bit of an idea about your thoughts about the economy in general right now?
Sure. If we're in a recovery, it's a pretty fragile one. The numbers don't look great. Unemployment was 6.1% in May, the highest in 9 years. Consumer confidence was way down, the most recent Michigan survey, so that didn't look very good. The dollar is weaker, and of course that has the good side that it makes our imports cheaper abroad. The core consumer prices, excluding volatile categories such as food and fuel, were flat in both March and April, and this is making people frightened about the possibility of deflation, which is a real scary thing. Interest rates hit new lows. In fact, money market funds are below 1%. However, there are some glimmerings of hope, and there's been a surge in mortgage refinancing, and in fact, their retail sales are up just a little bit. People are beginning to buy furniture and appliances and such things again, which is good for the economy. We've got the tax package kicking in, and that's expected to add to GDP. And the New York Fed, the most recent information suggests the manufacturing activity index has surged in the last month, so that's good. There are some brave people that are predicting quite large earnings growth, especially in the fourth quarter. And, of course, Wall Street is looking good as of yesterday. So maybe we're turning the corner. Let's hope so.
Good job, Eleanor. Richard, Eleanor, it sounds like she's trying to be optimistic, but she can't quite get it completely out. And in the recent outlook that you published, you said that there are some indicators that have been bullish, but quoting from your piece here, you say signs of actual improvement are less compelling.
That's right, but I don't think it's reason to despair. To understand why, I think we have to go back and look at where we were last fall when the U.S. economy really began to decelerate dramatically, to which I attribute geopolitical uncertainty as being the prime factor. When that happened, and I'm talking about last September, we saw with tremendous precision and immediacy, a number of leading indicators begin to deteriorate. We began to see the stock market turn down, volatility increased, credit spreads or the premium that bond investors demand for purchasing corporates over secure U.S. Treasuries all increased. And then within a period of 2 months, we saw it trickle through to the real economy with job losses and declining manufacturing activity. What we've seen in the past 2 months is that all of those leading indicators that foretold the slowdown last summer are now foretelling an improving economy going forward. Stocks are up tremendously, yields, credit spreads have narrowed, volatility has improved, and confidence is up on the whole. But the question is, do we see the follow-through with the economy? That is, do businesses alter their behavior in such a way as to actually give traction and credence to these leading indicators? And on that score, since I wrote that last piece, I think the information is increasingly upbeat. Now, I don't want to oversell the case. It's not as though the economy can turn on a dime, even though financial markets may. But what we're seeing at this point, with about 10 weeks between where we sit today and the fall of Baghdad, is that manufacturing activity is picking up. Leading indicators like orders for new merchandise have picked up in the month of May, and as we start to get information on June, are even more upbeat. So I think the reason to be optimistic is that we're seeing this transition from just a sentiment-led improvement to one that's beginning to get traction in the real economy. And the best news, as Eleanor just said, is that there's more help on the way. The tax package that was passed just a month or so ago has a lot more bang for the buck than, well, not for the buck, but let me just say a lot more bang than either of the two stimulus packages passed in 2002 or 2001, and that starts in just a week.
Yeah, and by the way, there was only a couple of weeks ago that he signed that, by the way, that was the 1st of June. And you both have laid out so many targets. This is what I call a target-rich opportunity, target-rich environment here, folks, with all these different things to talk about. I want to come back to one thing, though. Let's just for a minute, let's talk about the stock market. Richard, you brought that up. Is Eleanor, do you think the stock market is being a little bit excitable and a little bit maybe a little too optimistic?
No, I don't think so. I was pleased with the reaction, and it seems to be across the board now, both large cap and medium.
Yeah, Richard, it closed above 9,000 again.
Right.
Recently, what do you think? You think a little too optimistic, or maybe, as Goldilocks said, maybe just right?
Oh, I think it's got a way to go, actually. I don't think it's too optimistic at all, Jim.
Yeah.
To put some numbers on this, I mean, without getting technical, I mean, one way that investors typically value the stock market is to look at the price relative to the earnings of corporations. Mm-hmm. For the S&P 500 companies, that ratio for this year, 2003, is about 17, a price-to-earnings multiple of about 17. Now, historically, if you look at where P.E. multiples have been when interest rates are in the environment that they occupy today, that is to say, historic lows, you can easily justify a price-to-earnings multiple several points higher. And then you layer on top of that the benefits of dividends, tax exclusions, and capital gains tax cuts. I think the stock market, even in light of the 25% increase, is still attractive.
Hold on to that thought, Richard. Well said, by the way, and right under the wire, too. 20 after, we'll be right back with our good friends Eleanor Solomon and Richard Decatur. Decatur, stay with us. We'll be right back. We're back. It's 23 after. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate, 800-531-3815, toll-free coast-to-coast. Eleanor Solomon and Richard Decatur are our guests, and we're talking about the economy, and ultimately this hour we'll be talking about what we think the Fed's going to do next week when they meet a week from today, and to find out, we're going to do a little predicting on that. Eleanor, either you or Richard, I've forgotten which one, brought up, I think it was Richard, brought up the employment situation, or maybe it was you, the unemployment situation. I think you said 6.1,
right,
which is a 9-year high. But now it just seems interesting. Isn't it paradoxical that the economy seems to be rebounding? The stock market certainly likes the news, and yet we've got this. On the other hand, we've got this 9-year high unemployment rate. I know that employment is a lagging indicator. You and Richard both have taught us that over the years. It's a lagging indicator in terms of coming out of a recovery, but it's the contrast is very interesting, isn't it?
And on the other hand, the applications for unemployment benefits last week dropped by a seasonally adjusted 17,000.
So that's good news.
That doesn't lag quite as much because it's last week.
No.
And so that is good news.
Yeah, that's good news. But Richard, there seems to me that there's such an interesting thing to me to see how we've changed from the 20th century to the 21st century. So many things have just completely changed significantly, and one of those is the way we employ our people in America. I fear that we've got a whole sector of our population that's not ready for the 21st century employment.
Well, you're talking about a skill mismatch. That is to say, the skills people bring to the market aren't the same ones that businesses are demanding. And there's always some of that, but I don't know that it's more so today than it has been in the past. That's usually what economists refer to as an element of frictional unemployment.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, people can't find jobs, not because they're not skilled, but they don't have the right talents. I think there's always some of that with us, Jim, but really no evidence to suggest that more than usual. And if we look really, you know, just to focus again on the actual real recent trends, one of the changes in the unemployment in the labor market that we've seen in recent years has been that firms increasingly resort to the so-called contingent workforce or temporaries when they're in moments of uncertainty rather than adding permanents with all the fixed costs that come with them. And here also, just to continue to make the same point, there's a lot of reason for optimism. If you look at the last employment report, that is for the month of May, there was a tidal wave of hiring of temporary workers. That means that the demand for labor has increased, but businesses aren't sure enough mm-hmm. that they want to take on those costs permanently. However, historically, that foretells permanent hiring down the road. So again, even in this lagging sector of the economy, I think there's reason to be upbeat about more hiring coming our way.
You know what that also foretells, Eleanor, is more small businesses. Because a lot of those people who are being hired part-time are independent contractors who have decided to have multiple bosses, like I did back in the 80s after I was downsized after 23 years of being a good employee. And so I see more and more of that. And some of those people are going to become employees again.
Exactly.
But a lot of them are not. A lot of them are going to do just what I did, which is to hang a shingle out and say, hey, I'm in business,
right.
And I'm for hire.
Right. I think this is a good opportunity for small businesses.
It's another reason why I consider the 21st century to be the century of the entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. I think we're manufacturing entrepreneurs because I think more and more people are saying, you know what, I don't have to be tethered to a major corporation. I can make a living on my own working for those corporations, but having them be part-time employers.
Right. And the technology permits this. You can outsource, work from your home, and link together all kinds of different entrepreneurs. It's a new way of doing business.
Exactly.
And I think it's great. It's great.
Richard, though, to your point about you see no significant difference in the workforce today than, say, a few years ago, I think I disagree with you on that because we've lost tens and maybe hundreds of thousands of jobs that were perennial jobs in America, textile jobs that don't exist in America anymore. That's, to me, that's a major paradigm shift. Another thing, I talked to a guy who manages a paper factory. They make tissue paper, and it's a brand new factory. They have 400 employees. He said the factory that this replaced basically had 800 employees. So that's 400 fewer employees to do the same job because of technology. He said, we don't have a job in our plant that doesn't – everybody who shows up at our plant has to touch a computer to do their job.
Oh, yeah, no, maybe I misspoke, but I definitely think the labor market has changed and the demands made on labor have changed, and they constantly do. I guess what I was taking exception to was the notion that somehow this is different, and that is to say that today the big emphasis is on computerization, but if you went back 50 years, you'd see people who had gone from crafts trades into machining, and then from machining to the first uses of computers. So the process of technological change is constant and maybe speeds up and slows down from time to time, but is always ongoing. And to the extent that it takes people, that is, folks who have not kept up with the times, have not developed their skills as the economy has changed, they tend to fall by the wayside. And there's no doubt that's happening today, but again, it's...
You didn't misspeak. I took your meaning exactly right. It's just that, I understood what you meant. But anyway, that's we're going to pick back up on this, folks, when we come back after these messages. I want to ask them about the big D when we come back. Deflation. Do we have it? Is it here? Is it widespread? Is it dangerous? Stand by. Quick break, right back. This show is brought to you by IBM and Office Depot, 29 after.
He inspires small business.
We can teach these barbarians a lesson in Western methods and efficiency that will put them to shame.
He tells it like it is.
I realize how difficult it's going to be in this godforsaken place where you can't find what you need. And there's the challenge.
He's Jim Blasingame, the small business advocate.
With all due respect, sir, I believe this is going to be our finest hour.
We're back at 34 after. I'm Jim Blasingame, and my website is www.jbsba.com. Don't forget to subscribe to my free newsletter. The article this week is titled, has the title that we're of the topic that we're going to talk about right now with our good friends Eleanor Solomon, the author of Virtual Money, and Richard DeKayser, chief economist with National City Bank, and also vice president there with that bank, senior vice president, I should say. And Richard and Eleanor have joined us this hour to talk to us, as we do every 6 weeks or so whenever the Fed meets, to talk about what we think the Fed's going to do. But the title of my article is Deflation 2003, and you've still got time to get that if you subscribe this week. And that's the topic of this segment. I want to talk about deflation. I want to talk about a little bit about what it is, a little bit about what causes it, and if we actually do have it, if it's a big concern. You know, we've got some people in the Brain Trust. One person in the Brain Trust who is who's a specialist in deflation. His name is Gary Schilling, who's written a book actually on deflation. And Richard, why don't you define deflation for us?
Sure, and this is important. Deflation is a persistent fall in prices for the majority of goods and services. The two key words there are persistent, that is a month or two or even a quarter or two doesn't make it, and the majority of prices, meaning it can't be just falling oil prices, but it has to be pervasive across society.
Mm-hmm. And just like a growing economy raises all boats, deflationary economy sinks all boats, doesn't it?
Well, it does, and it's a terrible situation, which is why the Federal Reserve officials are so worried about it. And their principal concerns are two. Number one, prices are falling because interest rates are bounded by zero on the low side. They can never make real interest rates negative. That is, they can't get interest rates below the inflation level. That's one concern. It tends to neuter monetary policy. But number two is that debt, and there's lots of debt in society. Debt will rise in real value because if your existing level of debt is held fixed, but the income which you're using to service that debt is falling because of falling prices, the actual effect of debt is to increase, and the burden of that debt is to increase. So we want to avoid this at all costs.
Eleanor, are we in danger of widespread, broad-based deflation?
Well, I am not too concerned about this because I think the Fed has the tools in its arsenal of weapons to do something about it. I know Governor Bernanke, he was professor at Princeton, the Fed's newest governor, gave a speech on this way back last December, and it seemed a little premature at the time, and it doesn't now. And he discussed the various things the Fed could do about this.
Mm-hmm. Well, what are some? Of course, they've lowered interest rates, but they're down to what, one and a quarter
right.
points on the Fed funds rate. I mean, Richard, they're about. Eleanor mentioned ammunition, but aren't they about to run out of ammunition?
No, I don't think so, Jim. First of all, there is some distance still between one and a quarter and zero, and they've got that room to run with, should they choose to do so. But some of the quote unconventional approaches that Eleanor alluded to still remain in the quiver, and specifically the one that they'd likely resort to next would be to attempt to directly lower long-term interest rates by purchasing government securities and Fannie Mae, Freddie Mae debt, because that would help to – it's longer-term interest rates that really drive people's investment decisions. So they could do that. And then a third thing they could do is simply announce a very specific price level or inflation rate target as their objective, which I think psychologically would help people overcome the fear. That is, if the Fed's on the job targeting something which means that revenues will be rising, not falling, that could have an effect in stimulating them to hire and invest and so on and so forth. So all of these things are still available to the Fed, and I share Eleanor's confidence that they will prevent it from actually occurring.
Eleanor?
Yes. If you try to lower long-term interest rates, you're out there buying long-term bonds, government bonds perhaps, and pushing long-term rates down, which therefore benefits all sectors of society, and at the same time increase the money supply, because the FOMC would be buying these, paying for them with assets, which would constitute money,
mm-hmm.
liabilities of Fed banks.
Stand by. Eleanor, stand by. Richard, we're going to take a quick break, folks. It's 20 till. We'll be right back with our good friends Eleanor Solomon and Rich DeKayser. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate. Stay with us. We're back at 7 till. I'm sorry, 17 till. 17 till 1-7 until the hour. I'm Jim Blasingame, the guy who can't tell time. And let me remind you about the next hour. Georgia Donovan's going to join us. She's going to try to teach me how to be charming. And boy, does she have her work cut out for her. She's going to talk to us how to be charming in business. And she promised me that by the end of our visit that I would actually be charming. And so you'd want to, I know you want to make sure you wait around and see that. That'll be a sight to behold. And then after that, we'll be visiting with Monica Lichtfeld, who's Executive Vice President for e-commerce with Office Depot. And we're going to talk about e-business, your e-business. And that's coming up in the next hour. Eleanor Solomon and Richard DeKayser are our guests and our good friends. Richard, give us your website, the website of National City Bank.
Couldn't be easier. NationalCity.com. That's
all
National
right.
City is one word, .com.
And how many banking units have you got around the Midwest?
Oh, we've got over 1,200 branches stretching from Michigan to Kentucky and Pittsburgh to Chicago and over 2,000 ATMs.
And you're a very proud SBA lender, aren't you?
Yes, we are number one in at least two of the six states we occupy and in the top three in all the rest.
Yeah, check them out, folks, if you're in that part of the world. Eleanor Solomon's book is called Virtual Money. It's still available. It's an outstanding book if you want to see how money moves through electronic space. Virtual Money, you probably find it also, Eleanor, I would think, at all the libraries, too.
Yes.
Okay, let's talk a little bit more about deflation, but not too much more. Deflation is in front of our very eyes, but a lot of it is good deflation.
Mm-hmm.
When the cell phone that cost $500 10 years ago is now $25, and it's a lot more features rich than the one 10 years ago, or maybe even it's free because they give you the phone to buy the service. I mean, isn't that good deflation, Eleanor?
Yes, it certainly is. When I replace my fax machine with a much better one at half the cost, that's good too.
But Richard, it's not good if you own too many of those fax machines that Eleanor just got rid of.
Well, no, you know, I'm not. Well, you mean if you're the producer of those fax machines?
Yeah, I've got too much inventory of something that's if I bought a whole bunch of inventory and I'm holding you know stuff that the new model's coming out and it's half the price, I'm in trouble.
Well, that's right. But presumably, if you're developing the new model, you've got a good handle on when the new model's going to render obsolete
the old model. But if I'm a small business retailer holding on to some of those things,
that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, you got to be careful, folks. Richard, this is another reason why just-in-time inventory practices is a good idea, isn't it?
Well, it is, and we've seen that in spades over the years, increasingly in just the past business cycle. And, in fact, if you go back to just last autumn, we saw inventory levels literally at the leanest level ever, which suggests that there's a sensitivity to these issues and that firms are trying to stay ahead of the curve or at least not fall too far behind by not getting overloaded.
I believe, and from a practical standpoint, from where the rubber meets the road, businesses themselves, by practicing just-in-time inventory over the last 20 years, Eleanor, have done as much to avert significant damaging recessions as anybody else in the marketplace. Would you agree or disagree with that?
No, I would agree with that.
Richard?
Yeah, definitely a help.
So good for you, small business owners, for doing your part. I mean, you probably never thought about it, but all the great things that Mr. Greenspan and his crew do up there to help us avoid recessions. You do your part, too, by practicing just-in-time management practices, inventory practices. Okay, let's move over and talk about the dollar. The dollar is down. It's weaker. The president says that we want to strengthen it, but the government's not doing much to strengthen it. Eleanor, what do you think? Is it a good thing that the dollar is weakening a little bit?
Well, a little bit. Okay. Again, too much weakness is bad, especially if it's volatility.
Well, it's a good thing for our manufacturers, isn't it?
Right. But, it produces inflationary pressures, but we're not particularly worried about that at the moment.
But, Richard, we need our manufacturers to buy capital goods, and what better way to get them to buy capital goods than to increase their opportunities abroad?
Well, yeah, I think a falling dollar is an unambiguously wonderful thing for our economy today. And let me tell you why. There's two sides to this. Number one, if the dollar falls, that, as you just put it, makes U.S. goods at the same price they're selling for today, cheaper overseas, and hence improves our export performance. Ditto, on the other side, it makes imports relatively more expensive, so to the extent that we are all buying more things, we'll tend to find domestic products more attractive. That's exactly what our country needs right now. Now, the second part is related to the deflation story. Mm-hmm. That is to say, as Eleanor just pointed out, a falling dollar will tend to make imports more expensive and generally cause price pressures to rise. But if, in fact, our concern at this precise moment is the exact opposite, worry about deflation, then here, too, a falling dollar is still good news. So I think there's nothing but good news in what's happened. I think more would be better. Eleanor did allude to the pace, which is a concern, which is to say if it turns into an abrupt free fall, foreign investors could pull out of the U.S. economy because they suffer losses in that case. Mm-hmm. But so far, it's been a relatively gradual process and a good one for us all.
You know, one of the ways to tell if the dollar is going to go down is to find out whether I'm going to Europe or not. That's one way. Every time I'm going to Stockholm next week, as I announced once before on the show, and I'll talk about later in the week. And anytime I travel to Europe, the dollar always drops against the euro, or against any of the European currencies. And so that's always one way to tell. It's sort of my bad luck. Okay, we're going to take a quick break in just a few seconds, and when we come back, we're going to get the predictions that we promised you. What's the Fed going to do when they meet next week? Are they going to cut rates? Are they going to leave them the same, or are they going to raise them? I don't think they're going to raise them. We're going to see what Richard DeKayser and Eleanor Solomon have to say about that right after these messages, and I'm going to ask them how big a deal they think the tax cuts are going to be for the economy. That's coming up right after these messages. It's 10 till. Stay with us. We're back at 7 till. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate. Richard DeKayser is Chief Economist and Senior Vice President with National City Bank. Eleanor Solomon is the author of Virtual Money. They're both with us right now as we wrap up this Fed Watch show that we're having today. Eleanor, some people who think that the Fed will actually cut rates again tomorrow, that they're talking so much about deflation, that so much seems to be so much more on their minds right now, and they want to make sure that this economy has plenty of fuel. And there are some people who are saying that they think there may be some activity next week when the Fed meets. What do you think?
And the market expects this. Now, of course, a lot will depend on what happens in the next week because the news has been fairly good recently.
Right.
Going to happen? Well, as of this present moment, I think the Fed probably has to do something in terms of cutting on the downside with all the, you know, talk of inflation.
You think they'll go more than a quarter of a point?
No, I don't think they'll do that. I mean, I certainly wouldn't.
Yeah.
I might, you know, give the token one quarter. But if things improve in the next week, I wouldn't even do that.
And they're not meeting for a week, and Richard, is one percentage point on the Fed funds rate a nice round number for you?
Well, I don't know. It, it seems clear they're going to cut the Fed funds rate, whether it's a quarter point or a half a point. I really can't say at this point. Frankly, I don't think they themselves have made that decision. But
a half point? You're introducing the half point possibility.
Oh, yeah.
That gets it down to three quarters of a point.
Yeah, that's right. Wouldn't that be sweet?
Wow.
And I totally agree with Eleanor. I don't think they need to do anything at all. I think that there's plenty of stimulus in the pipeline to get the economy going in the second half of the year. But their public remarks in recent weeks have suggested a discomfort, not with deflation. It doesn't exist, and they don't expect it to. They're very quick to adamantly add that. However, given the uncertainties and the risks, they're essentially asking the question, what's to be lost by doing this? What's to be lost by lowering interest rates even further?
And they've also got the example of Japan, who waited too long to use their ammunition, didn't they?
Well, that's the key, yes. One of the lessons that was drawn from Japan, and again, I don't want the analogies to go too far,
right,
because there are tremendous
differences. I agree.
But one of the lessons they've drawn from that experience is that the central bank there was, quote, behind the curve. That is to say that they consistently responded rather than anticipated events. So you can draw from that the conclusion that they're not going to be laggards. They're going to be leaders.
Mm-hmm. Well said, both of you. And I've got a minute each to talk about the tax cuts. Eleanor, will the president's job stimulation bill to grow our economy and by cutting taxes, is it going to help?
Yes, it is, especially the rebates, which are coming pretty soon.
Yeah. All right. Well, that didn't take long. Richard, what do you think?
It's huge. It's absolutely huge. The $350 billion 10-year cost is highly misleading. It's at least double that if you assume correctly that all these reversals that are scheduled for future years don't happen. And more importantly, if you look at the near term, that is to say the next 15 months or so, this tax package is more stimulative than either of the prior two packages or the two put together even.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about a number that is about 1.3% of GDP. That's nothing to sneeze at. And coming in the context of an economy that I think would be improving anyhow, again, I can't say it too many times, but there's good reason to be optimistic.
Well, I agree with both of you. And I've been, as you probably know, I've been covering this tax bill, the progress it's been making for a number of months, and have been telling people. I've written articles about this, talking about the benefits that it's going to be. I think the impact is going to be enormous.
Yeah.
I think that the sleeper in the whole thing that you almost don't hear anybody talking about is the direct expensing increase for small business. When you give, I mean, needing an extra $75,000 in direct expensing is not going to help all small businesses, but there are enough out there, enough emerging small businesses out there that will use that I think that sector alone could have a big impact on the economy.
That's right. Let me hasten to add, well, before we get too carried away with the enthusiasm of the good it's going to deliver, and it will in the next year and a half or 2 years, it does have long-term consequences, and that is to say that our deficit situation has got from bad to worse. And when we start getting 3 and 4 and 5 years out, I think we're going to be back to the kind of situation we were in the late 1980s, where we've got a problem on our hands.
But if we can produce, Richard, it just seems to me that production is the key to this whole thing. And I'm afraid I've got to have the last word, even if I'm not right, Richard. Richard DeKayser and Eleanor Solomon, thank you both for being here. Good job. We'll see you next time. Got to go for this hour. Before I do, I want to thank my heroes, small business owners. This is Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate, and this program is for you.
Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., intended for the private use of our audience. Except as otherwise provided by copyright law, all other copying, redistribution, or publication without prior written consent is prohibited. All rights reserved.